my pleasure to welcome here Dr. Professor Rick Rose from McGill. He's been around for a long time. I know him since his days in AT&T and Lincoln Labs and so on. I know that he got his degree from Georgia Tech, right? Some time ago. Around for a number of years working mainly on what I know, a lot of issues of adaptation, and recently he got into things which almost nobody works on, which is like deep neural networks and speech. He will tell us something about it. It's a great pleasure to have him here. Rick will be here on Thursday, so you can keep asking questions, saying whatever you want to know. He sits in our room in S8, and in general, he's a diligent worker. He's here from morning till evening, and so on. I think that is all what I can say. I mean, it's very pleasant to have him here.
Thanks.
Talk on what he's interested in right now.
Thanks a lot. I just noticed my name isn't on any of the slides, so again, I've got it right here in case anybody needs to reference it. I apologize.
A-N-O-M.
I'm sorry?
Your name is A-N-O-M.
Thank you, Anonymous. All right. So, I guess I should, I think I'd like to motivate what I'm going to talk about today in terms of our, some of what our speech gang is working on, which is sort of knowing what you don't know about speech. And so what I'm going to talk about really are acoustic modeling approaches that are based on manifold representations and based on the idea that we often assume that speech features can be characterized as lying in a low dimensional manifold embedded in a very high dimensional space. And this is kind of wrinkly, I guess. I guess we're okay, though. These can be highly nonlinear, but have nice locally linear properties. We can assume that local neighborhoods are Euclidean, and that on certain manifolds that you could talk about things like curvature and things in a local way. And so, in reference to our knowing what we don't know problem, we could perhaps assume that we might try and know something about the manifold properties, right? That, in other words, what general shape this space that speech will lie in, and then we could perhaps then say, well, given a set of speech features, what are the departure from the assumptions we have about the assumed underlying manifold? So we could perhaps then analyze features to determine if local neighborhoods aren't preserved or local shape assumptions are violated. So this is kind of what I came here thinking that we might be able to contribute. But for my talk today, this morning, I'd like to talk about sort of a couple of applications, and maybe to hopefully give people feeling for how we apply manifold constraints in acoustic modeling for speech processing and speech recognition. So I'll talk about an approach for learning linear dimensionality reducing transformations for speech recognition, and talk about how we can do this by improve the performance of these things by preserving basically locality constraints in a transformed space, and at the same time talk about separability of points along a manifold. And we'll do that by incorporating the notion of robust kernels. There is an issue with complexity. We form these graphs, which include all of the points in our data set, and in some of these large continuous speech recognition problems, there can be billions of points, and so that's a billion squared neighborhood relationships. And so there's an issue of efficiency, and we address that using the notion of locality-sensitive hashing. I don't know how much time I'll have to talk about that, but just a caveat that, yeah, there's a lot of complexity here, but there are ways of dealing with that. But what I'd really like to talk about was how we can apply the notion of a manifold in improving the performance of deep neural network training algorithms. And hopefully I'll have time to give a feeling for why that's a good thing and how that actually might be used to our benefit in learning about what we don't know about speech. So, this very first application. So the people who are not speech guys might not be familiar with this problem, but in general in speech, we try and model a sort of long-term dynamical spectral dynamics. And what we do is we'll actually model an individual speech frame, which is on the order of, say, 10 or 20 milliseconds. And then to model the dynamics, we'll just stack a bunch of frames. And so when we do that, we get this fairly high dimensional representation, and we can cope with that by coming up with a linear dimensionality reducing feature transformation, which takes us from this very high dimensional thing that might represent, say, a quarter of a second of speech with hundreds of dimensions down to on the order of tens, a dimension on the order of tens of feature components. And so the idea is we want to come up with a dimensionality reducing linear transformation, and the techniques for doing this differ in the criteria that we're trying to optimize in the transformed space. Okay? And so that's sort of the first application I want to talk about. Lots of techniques for doing that, and most people who have taken a machine learning course has learned about linear discriminant analysis, where you're going to come up with a transform that's going to optimize some notion of class separability in your transform space. In terms of manifold-based techniques, locality-preserving projections. The idea is that you want to reduce some notion of neighborhood relationships that existed in the original space in this transform space. So two vectors that are close here will also be close in your transform space. And then a variant or sort of a combination of both of these things, if we could preserve both locality and discriminability along a manifold in the transformed space. Okay, so it's these are the general notions that we're dealing with. So, really what we assume here is that we have potentially high dimensional data, in this case two, that's not particularly high, and we'll assume that these data points are lying on or close to the surface of a lower dimensional manifold. And we could talk about locality. We'll apply these constraints by defining local neighborhoods, and we'll then define a graph, an intrinsic graph, whose nodes consist of the points these vectors that lie along this space, and the weights along the arcs connecting these points correspond to these kernel-based distances between the nearest neighbor points, and in this case, there's a Gaussian kernel, and you could talk about there being a normal correlation-based kernels, depending on what you might consider as to be sort of the natural definition of distances in your space. So there is kind of a twist on this notion of neighborhood relationships. We could also talk about there being multiple classes that exist along, that our points fall into along this manifold. And we could then sort of modify this notion of a neighborhood. Now we'll talk about a penalty neighborhood, and this locality we'll talk about a point within a given class, and we're concerned about its relationships in a neighborhood to points in a different class, right? So we'll refer to these as penalty neighborhoods, okay? And so for each vector in along our manifold will define a neighborhood for a given point, and the neighborhood will be consisting of those points in other classes, or in this case in class 1 or class 2. And so the idea then is that we can then use this combination, just as like if, for those people who are familiar with linear discriminant analysis, there's sort of within class and between class scatter. Here we have some notion of neighborhoods that are sort of amongst points that are within the same class and neighborhoods that are sort of across class. And so we'll use this to define now the notion of a penalty graph. Again, the points of this graph will be the actual data points, and the weights on the arcs connecting the nodes of the graph will now be kernel neighborhoods where each weight is computed over neighbors of this point, but not within the same class. So what can we use this for? I mentioned this business of coming up with these. What can I do here? I mentioned our initial problem here of trying to come up with the now a linear transformation. We've got these nonlinear. We're assuming that our vectors lie in these nonlinear manifolds. But really, what we're trying to estimate here are the parameters of this linear feature space transformation. And so, what we want to do is we want to come up with a criterion for estimating the parameters of this linear feature space transformation. Okay, and so we start off by defining what we refer to as our intrinsic graph. This is the one where the neighborhood relationships are in class, and the weights of this intrinsic matrix correspond to the these kernel relationships between points, and we'll estimate this penalty graph where the weights in this penalty matrix now correspond to the kernel relationships amongst nearest neighbors. And what we want to do then is we want to identify this transformation matrix P to come up with transformed feature vectors going from a high dimensional to a lower dimensional space. And we're going to maximize this optimization criterion, which really is a ratio of scatter, in this case, scatters depending on our penalty graph and scatters depending on our intrinsic graph. And in that case, it turns out this is going to expand into these two terms. This D here are the column-wise sums of our intrinsic and penalty matrices. The D minus W is what people are familiar with as a Laplacian. And so it turns out we can solve this in a pretty straightforward way by using this generalized eigenequation where the P's here correspond to the columns of our linear transformation matrix, and we're solving for the eigenvalues of these things. And we can then come up with the estimate for the linear transformation P. Simple enough. So it really boils down to these two parts. First part, we have our features, our class labels. We go through this huge n squared, well, if we have on the order of t vectors, we go through this huge process of computing the nearest neighbor kernels for our entire data set, and we come up with these intrinsic and penalty matrices. And the rub here is that the complexity associated with this is dominated by the t-squared process of computing all these nearest neighbor relationships. Then as a second step, we're going to estimate the linear feature space transformation, and hopefully this thing both preserves locality between points in our transform space along a manifold, and also maintains this notion of class separability for the points along the manifold. And we can look and see how well that does. Remember, we're trying to estimate this feature space transformation. We're assuming we have these stacked features of concatenated spectral representations, and we're going to evaluate this on a fairly small corpus by Google standards, which they literally have, like, I think for their tasks, they have like a year, 9,000 hours of labeled speech to train their systems. So we're whatever fraction 14 over 9,000 is of that. But these are all mixed noise recordings, and then we test on utterances that are taken from a bunch of noise types at a bunch of different signal-to-noise ratios. And then we, there's the issue, there's classes. Well, we define there to be about 120 classes. Our input dimensionality is a little over 100, and the output is about 40. And so the bottom line, I'm going a little bit fast because I know the text people are, I could see them yawning. And the bottom line is, this is also typical for those people not familiar with robust speech. We fill massive tables with lots of numbers, so many that there's no way you could read them, and then I tell you what you think about it. And so if basically what we have here is we have looking at the performance over a range of conditions. The baseline is just, I think, the traditional features that we use in automatic speech recognition. This is using linear discriminant analysis to do this feature space dimensionality reduction, and this is the technique we're talking about here, the locality preserving discriminant analysis. And what we can, if you took the time to look at all of them, you'd see we get about a 20% improvement using this locality preserving discriminant analysis relative to LDA. So I think the message here is that by preserving some notion of sort of the structure of speech in the transformed space, we think that we get this advantage in this locality preserving discriminant analysis. Okay, I was trying not to use sort of our nomenclature. There's basically a spectral representation where you do kind of a linear transformation to more or less diagonalize the components. It's called Mel frequency Kepstrom coefficients. So, again, I'm trying to be nice to the text people so they don't start checking their Facebook pages right away. Okay, so I might, maybe I'm okay. So I mentioned the rub here was this issue of complexity. And for that, I think many people in text probably are familiar with the notion of locality-sensitive hashing. It's basically a fast, approximate, nearest neighbor computation, approach for a fast, approximate, nearest neighbor. And the general idea, our problem here is if we have thousands of hours of speech, we have billions of these frames going along at around 100 per second, right, in speech. And so the idea here is we can basically use this randomized algorithm for hashing vectors into bins, and we're making things faster by making it so that adjacent vectors are more likely to fall into the same bin. And what we want to do is apply this to fast computation of these neighborhood graphs that I showed a minute ago, and we'd like to be able to reduce complexity with a minimum impact of ASR performance. And to sort of steal my own thunder here, really what we were able to do was knock down the complexity by about an order of magnitude with more or less zero impact on performance. And I could quickly rush through a sort of a block diagram of how all this works. We start with an input vector that's in some d-dimensional space. Then we perform some random projections to map this vector onto a real line. And these random projections are chosen so that, vectors that are close wind up in the same segment of this real line, and vectors that are not close might fall into different bins. Then we go through this hashing process where we will hash points here into buckets, and again, points that are close should fall into the same bucket. Points that are not close should not. And so we would hopefully have, hash hits when points are close, and we'll have anywhere of around 8 to 10,000 bins. Then to prevent some unfortunate cache misses in this process, we'll come up with multiple of these hash tables, all formed by using different sets of random projections. So, yes?
Is there an issue with D? How do you find D?
Well, we're assuming D is what we started with, Right? So that's what we're given. In what? In optimizing the locality sensitive hashing? Well, I mean, there are dependencies on the number of tables and the number of projections and so on. So it's an issue. We don't ignore the relationship between those. But at least in our work, we're assuming we're starting with D and going on. Now, yes, here's a. Okay, yeah. I mean, you being a text guy, I would think you would be mostly dealing with sort of Hamming distances and these sorts of projections. Yeah.
But the point is just methodologically, the D is not known ahead of time.
Well, okay, let me go on then, and I'll get to issues we had. But then the process then of computing nearest neighbors is you come in with a point, you hash to your various tables, and then you take the union of the points in these buckets, and you can search over this much smaller number of candidates to find your nearest neighbors. And so our issue here is we did look at a number of different parameterizations, and I won't sake of time, I won't go too deeply into that, but we basically started with about 1.5 million frames, and we looked at various different number of projections and so on, number of tables, and what this curve shows is we have looking here at various different signal to noise ratios, and this is word error rate along the vertical axis, and each of these curves corresponds to different parameterizations of our of our tables, and the bottom curve here, this blue one, is when we use no locality sensitive hashing, and so this would be the baseline we'd like to achieve, and we found here that we could get a savings of about an order of magnitude, which is this dotted line here, at least at reasonable signal to noise ratios, without any sacrifice in word error rate. So that was what we were going for. So in practice, we did find that we had to sort of look at how we parameterize our hash tables given the characteristics of the feature space. So I guess any questions about this? Or? Now that we've okay, I'm going to go on now. This is really what I wanted to talk about here was the how we might be able to use this notion of manifolds to regularize the training of deep neural networks. And this is a topic that's been, they've basically taken over speech conferences. ICASM and InterSpeech just aren't what they used to be after DNNs came along. A lot of methods have been looked at to try and regularize or improve or reduce the tendency of standard training algorithms to wind up in local minimum undesirable local minimum. So there are the notion of generative, unsupervised generative pre-training of these networks to basically start you off so that the discriminative training is sort of a tuning on this supposedly nice surface. And variants along that where you do layer by layer discriminative pre-training using alternative nonlinear elements in your network that provide some kind of regularization. These are all things that people are doing and have different effect on different task domains. We sort of were interested in the fact that people had looked at the using different features for training DNNs and found that feature spaces with strong local constraints led to improved learning characteristics for DNNs. And so we thought that the manifold constraints here, this enforcing local local relationships amongst data points, might provide a nice way to sort of enforce locality and give us sort of these nice local constraints. And so we We also saw that other people had looked at using manifold regularization for doing, notably, I mean, people who are familiar with Parthan Yogi at University of Chicago and his student Belkin were looking at using manifold constraints and regularized least squares. So, it's pretty simple. We'd like to enforce these locality constraints, and the way we do it is simply by modifying the objective function this objective function in standard DNN gradient descent training, where we throw in this manifold constraint where the W's here, or the omegas, correspond to these kernel-based distances that we talked about in these local nearest neighborhoods along our manifold. And we even looked at this notion of an intrinsic and a penalty manifold, as I discussed at the very beginning, these penalty terms or these regularization terms. Right. So, okay, again, the issue of complexity. Not only do we need to deal with, at any given computation of the gradient, not only do we have to deal with a given data point, but we have to deal with all the data vectors in its neighborhood. So if we have k nearest neighbors in here, we multiply the computational complexity by a factor of k. So again, there's the rub. And that's why we might be the only ones working on this right now. The implications here is we're preserving the local relationships among speech feature vectors at the output of the DNN, and I'll show an example where you could see in the actual, we make sort of the computation of the gradient a bit more robust. The fact that you're pulling an entire neighborhood, or you're using an entire neighborhood of points to estimate a gradient seems to make this the process of implementing the gradient descent more robust. The problem here is both we have the cost of computing the nearest neighbors. Well, we perhaps have locality sensitive hashing to deal with that, but the process of computing the gradients along the manifold of the manifold regularized objective function is yet another issue. But the performance is kind of nice. Here is a simple task where we have only 4 hours of speech, but we have noise corrupted digit utterances, and I show performance along a range of signal to noise ratios in a bunch of noise conditions. Each one of these are word error rates, and this is our, you know, again, here's our baseline condition, the Mel frequency Kepstrom coefficients, which I reluctantly defined a minute ago. Here's the performance for a DNN, a deep neural network without manifold regularization, and Mr. DNN is actually manifold regularized DNN here. And lots of numbers, too many to read, so I'll tell you what you think. We get about a 20% reduction in error rate relative to the DNN trained without the manifold regularization. But again, the complexity is an issue, is that we increase the effort in computing the gradient by a factor of k, where that's the number of nearest neighbors. Okay, and again, I mentioned when I was talking about performance before, there was this larger, the Wall Street Journal utterances, we added noise to those. And again, we see relative to an unregularized DNN, we're getting something on the order, here still something like 15% on the average reduction in word error rate across all these various noise types.
Great.
Yes? Oh, hi, Vijay. Sorry?
What is the acoustic model used in the first case?
What is the acoustic model?
So you specify DNN as a separate thing. So what are you using to model?
I'm so sorry. Thank you for asking. Here's another term that the text people are going to get irritated with. This is actually being used in a tandem configuration. Okay? And so that means... Could I just leave it at that for now? And for, if anybody wants to know, I'll get. But yeah. So that what that means is we're actually training a DNN to estimate to discriminatively estimate features that are actually being handed over to another ASR system, and so the actual speech recognition system is separate from this. So yeah.
Rick, how often do you have to incur that high complexity stuff? Every utterance, or just?
Okay, you're setting me up for that discussion. Thank you for that. A simple example here of where the where this manifold regularization is good and where it's bad. So going back to your machine learning course when you were a freshman in high school, we have our objective function, and in this case it's a cross entropy objective function. We're going to estimate a gradient for that. To that objective function, and here the y's here at each time I here are obtained by forward propagation of my input through the nonlinear layers of my network, and I have my f is this nonlinearity, and I then use the gradient that I estimate here to update my parameters, according to a gradient descent algorithm, and when I'm done there, I will then. I'll then wind up with a updated parameters in my parameter space, and assuming this is a nicely behaved error surface in my simplified two-dimensional parameter space. Now, having recalled all that, when we have our manifold regularized objective function, we have this extra term where the omegas became they became W's and then they became omegas again, where these guys again are our weights that we've estimated from these kernel-based neighborhood distances. And are now when we estimate the gradient of this guy with respect to a weight in the matrix, weight in the network, we now have this extra term which incorporates all of the additional points, additional vectors that correspond to the k nearest neighbors of our original, y sub I. Okay, so this is what's new as a result of the manifold regularization. So the whole idea here is we start off with each of our input points here. We estimate a neighbor. We come up with a neighborhood. We estimate these omegas. They sit here. Okay. Then when so just as with unregularized gradient descent, we have to forward propagate our input through our network. Well, now we have to do it k more times. So this is a factor of k that we sort of incur in the process, and we do that for every point, right? And then, but the nice thing though is now, when we compute our gradient is sort of a superposition of the original gradient that we would have as a result of y sub I. But then we also are computing sort of components of that gradient with respect to all of our neighbors. So the overall gradient has the effect of sort of being pulled by a neighborhood rather than a single point. And that's sort of the good part, is you get this more robustness out of the process. And so that's really about it. I've sort of rushed through, but we also went through and compared what we've done here with other more well-known regularization approaches, generative pre-training. That has always been a mixed bag in speech applications. This was originally thought to be very important for DNN training for ASR, but it's turned out to not be that important and really had little effect on our task domains. Using alternative nonlinear units, alternates to the logistic regression, these these rectified linear units is something we're working on now. And let's see, the other obvious thing is just to compare with a norm regularizer. And that actually does help us. And we compared that with I've sort of repeated this table I had before. Here's our performance with the manifold regularized DNN. And when we just do the norm regularization, that also gives us some reduction in word error rate, but still not anywhere near as much as the manifold regularization gives us. So this was... So overall, I think I guess people who are familiar with Bengio's work, for example, there they'll look at a number of techniques where they basically will say these things perform a function that's very similar to, you know, to manifold learning. That, for example, they'll say, well, training a, you know, denoising autoencoders do something similar to learning a manifold. But here, the thing I like about these techniques, and I think we were originally motivated by Partha Nayogi's gang at University of Chicago, we're at a cost of some complexity. We're actually this notion of being able to preserve the structure of your original data in whether it's in your linearly or non-linearly transformed space really seems to have an impact. And I think we're kind of interested in looking to see whether, you know, if looking whether or not we know what distortions exist in our sort of knowing what we don't know task, if we can look and see whether we can have a test for determining whether or not this structure is really being preserved, whether or not local neighborhoods are preserved, or whether or not something funny has happened to our data. Yeah, Vijay.
So regarding the computational cost of your method, you're already computing the gradient for the backdrop. So why can't you just take a Taylor series approximation for computing the activation outputs? Maybe you just have your previous output, the new gradient which you already computed for the backdrop.
That was a Bengio thing. Basically what they were looking at is, rather than doing this, why not just you know, they can compute a Jacobian and then a second driven and have some kind of numerical approximation to it, rather than actually computing these weights from data. So that's a... Yeah?
I would like to make a more general comment. I noticed last week that everybody was always jumping directly into their problems, which of course eliminated about 95% of the audience. I think that we are maybe making a little bit the same error right now.
Okay.
Because I realized that somebody was asking me about features and that sort of thing. And we kind of also swept it under the carpet. We said, oh, this is just a tandem and that sort of thing.
Fair enough.
Attract our language friends, we have to ask them how much they even know about speech recognition.
Okay.
We may be surprised that they know a lot, but we may also be surprised that they also think that everything starts with words, and then, of course, then the word starts being interesting. So if somebody would be willing to, every time, at least point where this particular part of word fits into this problem of getting from the signal to the words, which to us, of course, is the meaning already, right? But I mean, for other people, that's where the whole problem starts. Would you be willing to do or something on a whiteboard right now, very informally, how the speech recognition is done? Or should I go and do it?
I was taking exactly the opposite tact, I think. I was basically saying these are vectors and we stack them up and so on.
Because they probably don't know.
Why don't they ask? Is there anything in particular I don't see it.
First of all, you should stop saying text guys and start saying language experts. We can build the communication on that.
I've just heard what they call us. That's the thing.
Right. There's probably quite a bit to share here.
Yeah.
Conceptually.
typically, well, I know that everybody is shy to say, I don't know. I mean, you know this.
Well, speak up.
We might not be as ignorant as you think.
Well, some of you may not, because you started St. Morgan's whatever meetings, right? But some of us might.
Well,
I readily admit that I have no idea what these language experts are talking about. But, you know, that's all we need.
Well, I don't want to get in the middle of that. Perhaps you could raise that issue some other time. So this is as far as I really got into the process of, you know, of like one of our applications was coming up with features that we would put in a speech recognizer. And I sort of assumed that for now that the notion of a feature vector that we extract from what we assume is a short time stationary, you know, windowed analysis frame is something that we could leave abstracted, but we could talk more about that if people are interested. The idea is in any of our acoustic modeling, we assume that all of our models are defined over these features that chunk along at about 100 frames per second, and that's a reasonable assumption because our articulators are only moving so fast. And so we assume that speech is stationary at about an interval of around 10 or 20 or 30 milliseconds. And so we'll apply a window to speech, we'll extract some features that really represent more or less the short time spectral envelope, and that's for reasons of we think phase is not terribly off. Well, I won't even touch that, but more or less proportional to the short time spectral envelope, and then that will represent each of these chunks. Now that ignores the issue of the spectral dynamics, right? There's a lot of research to show that we're sensitive to sort of very short time, fast moving phenomena in speech, and so that's the reason for stacking these guys. We basically, rather than somehow come up with a parametric model of these spectral dynamics, we just take a bunch of speech vectors, we stack them together, and hope we can incorporate that kind of spectral, the surrounding context that way. I don't know. It's difficult, I think, to give a speech tutorial. Right.
The system then uses them to find the best pass through the set of models, or best model which could have generated the given speed signal.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not something you should touch too much. You were mainly concerned about getting some better, I would think, measurements from the waveform.
Yeah.
Using deep neural networks, mm-hmm. They are very difficult to train. They have a lot of parameters, but we believe that by shrinking things so that they fall on manifold speech, you can speed up the things.
Yeah, well, you raise a good point, though. There's another issue that perhaps this notion of, there's been a lot of work in speech recognition on saying, let me somehow model the underlying, perhaps, articulatory properties, right? And so one might think that we've got a bunch of points here that fall on some manifold, and that manifold might be described by the physics of our articulatory system. We've got these loosely constrained articulators, and there's been a lot of work where people have said, well, let me come up with I'll start with some target articulatory positions. I'll then try to map those to the actual model, use some dynamical model to come up with the motion of articulators, and then map from there to the acoustics, and actually come up with a parametric representation of what this sort of underlying manifold might look like. And unfortunately, that's a hard problem that we've never been good at. You've got to, both coming up with the definition of the model and coming up with the learning algorithms that could train parameters of a model like that. It's people have not reached, there's been a lot of work and not a lot of success. So this is, you know, just sort of looking at the problem here as, gee, I've got some nice, I'll assume there's something nice here. You know, something with a nice behavior, nice local relationships, and I'm going to try and preserve that in whatever I'm doing, whether I'm transforming to a new space or.
So you assume that this black curve is something which maybe a Walker track might be doing, and the red points might be what actually is coming from your mouth.
Right. Right.
After the microphone.
Right. So somehow the physics, yeah. We'll assume, if we're going to assume that speech vectors fall on some nice manifold, we're going to assume that there's some physics responsible for that, and rather than try and model the process that where that came about, we're just going to sort of take advantage, hopefully, of the fact that we believe they're well behaved. Yeah, you did. Oh, I know.
We discussed that briefly with Jack, actually, that part of the reason of getting together like this is not that language experts talk to other language experts,
yeah.
But the language experts also talk to people who think the language is such a simple thing after you get a right, I mean, you don't have to worry anymore.
Yeah.
And they would like to convince speech people that this is not so, but at the same time, speech people should try the same thing, to say, well, you know, it's not, it's a long, difficult process from what people produce with the mouth and to get it into sequential words. And this is the principle, and those are the problems which we have. And right now, I'm addressing one particular one, right? And if we can,
of course, yeah.
To this principle, in general, if language experts do the same for speech people, that would be totally wonderful, because, you know, at the end, I don't know, is it a, what they are doing is a language model, or we understand the language model for your language expert people, but other than that, we don't know much about what you are trying to do, right? So it would be nice if we spend a little bit of time on this to position the problem we are talking about in this general thing. On one hand, we speak, on the other hand, the meaning comes out, right, somehow. But
I think we could turn it around. I mean, there was a very interesting workshop in Montreal a few years ago on the origins of language, and there were a lot of fascinating talks on, you know, how, and I'm sure I can't contribute anything to that, but what parts of cognition are dedicated to language and nothing else, and so on, but not much about the moving bits, right? The talking part, that was sort of an interesting dichotomy for me, that you can have this entire workshop and have everything from archaeologists to philosophers to Chomsky type people there, and nobody talking about the moving bits. So I don't know if they,
So I thought I would use it. So by no means speaking, picking up on the wonderful talk of Professor Rose, of course, but before we dive deep into talk, we have talk every day, so we should just use it for enriching our community by cross-pollinating between speech and language, remembering that language is very often spoken. And we worry about that. It was the topic of the original proposal, was how to get from spoken language to English. So, we should worry about it.
We did have a couple of years ago, there was a workshop, and who was the researcher who was at Merle at the time, who was looking at training language models strictly from the acoustics?
Wouldn't that be nice? Because, very
who was that?
Speak,
no symbols.
Right?
The symbols would be automatically derived in an unsupervised way, and strictly from the acoustics. And you would come up with a language model from that.
It would be wonderful if they can discuss how ridiculous this approach is.
We were seeing a Bhiksha Raj did that at a speech level.
And
Mari Ashtangar did something like that.
Well, this was at Merle. I think they might have been there when some of this work was done.
Sure. Yeah. Well, this was before Bhiksha went to Merle, in the early 90s.
Oh, cool.
But you're speaking of code. Nobody knows who Bhiksha is here.
Yes.
It wouldn't be enough to say it's part of the moving bits, is that? Sorry? Oh, okay. You're interrupting Hinek. I hope that's okay. Sorry about that.
That's the thing that's sort of used in machine translation sometimes, where you do discriminative training and then you put it into another, or you do a neural network and then put it into a discriminative training algorithm. So is that the typical setup with these?
Let's see. So the reason I sort of swept that over under the rug was because now if you dare to wander into a speech session at any of the any of our major conferences, much of the talk is on how you can build a speech recognizer, and hidden Markov model is the everything you've heard. They basically replaced, and these things were all based on Gaussians, and they now have sort of replaced Gaussians with a neural network to produce sort of the local probabilities of a sound unit at a given time. And so that they'll refer to that as a hybrid configuration, so a hybrid hidden Markov model neural network. And then the other thing that people are doing is, and they'll, in front of all of that, they'll have, we'll refer to as a tandem scenario, where you'll take perhaps these spectral features that I talked about a minute ago, you put those into a neural network, and it produces some sort of posteriors that themselves are used as features. And so this one box is just producing features, again at this sort of chunking along at, say, 100 frames per second. those go into a neural network, and that might also be this hybrid configuration that actually has the neural network producing the acoustic likelihoods. And so I think what we're finding, what the community is finding, is good things for training, let's say, this feature extraction box are also good things for training this hybrid configuration. And so that's why I sort of, I'm implicitly assuming that if this works well for the feature extraction box, it will also work well for the tandem situation. As far as the analogy with machine translation, okay.
I guess they were using the hybrid.
So they threw that in with the zillions of other things, and they use MERT to integrate all the.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Sure.
Basically, using the neural nets in speech recognition, there are essentially two ways. One is that you directly use your posteriors, or you scale them to become the likelihoods by dividing by priors. And you can feed them directly into what is called search. You can research for the best parts. The other way is that you treat these estimates of the posterior probabilities of the phonemes as the best features you can possibly get out of speech, and you just say, okay, instead of using spectrum, I will use these posteriors as the features. So this is what is called tandem approach. So those are two different things, and I think that Rick was using it as a tandem. That's what you wanted to say, right? So
there's a loose analogy there between, you know, throwing in the neural network as part of sort of integrating it with the rest of the features through MERT. I think as Yannick was saying, we're sort of going feature extraction as input to the next stage, where I think what you're talking about is sort of combining these neural network-based features with other features through MERT combination, yeah. So it's a little bit different, I think, in that sense, yeah. Okay, time. Okay.